it's really, it's nice to, having served in the institution. So I really appreciate it.
Well, very nice. It was an honor for us to do that today. And before I turn it over to Director Pogemiller, I want to call your attention to, in your packet, members, there's an article copied from the New York Times entitled, "For Poor, Leap to College Often Ends in a Hard Fall." So I have a request that you read it. I read it in December just online, and it really changed the way I thought about things. It chronicles the lives of three superstars who are in tough economic situations, and it chronicles their hard journey to make it through post-secondary. And you'll discover none of them make it. And the obstacles that came in their path were pretty tough. And just reading that shaped the way I thought about policy. So that's nothing more of that for today, but I just wanted you to know that I put it in there and would ask if you wouldn't just take the time to read it. So, Director Pogemiller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I visited with the chair, I think yesterday or the day before, and she suggested I try to intermix, because there's some new members of the committee, try to intermix what this shop does, but also put it into larger context as I talk about the governor's budget. So there is a lot of data here, and I'll move through some of it fairly quickly, but we can always come back to it if members need to, would like to. Okay, page up, I bet.
Page down.
So what does Office of Higher Ed do? We run the state financial aid programs. That's state grants, work study and child care grants, American Indian scholarships, tuition reciprocity, and something called self loans, which is a state subsidized loan program. We analyze student and post-secondary information across systems. We register private degree-granting institutions. And registration is really, it's not licensure. It's very light. Theoretically, we could say we're not going to register Augsburg. But, I mean, in reality, that's not going to kind of happen. But we do license, which is a little heavier, licensure for non-degree career schools. We run federal programs or grants, and there's two basic ones. There's something called Get Ready, where we have about 25. We've got about 65 people that work at OE. About 25 or 30 of them work on this federal grant, which is basically young staff people in middle and high schools helping kids get into college early. And it's all federal money, and we are part of a national group of states that are actually analyzing if that stuff works or not. So we're in about the fifth or sixth year of that grant. And then there's something called ICAP, which are grants to programs that help get kids into school, college. And then we're the fiscal agent, basically pass-through money for Minitex and MinLink, which some of you have heard about. There's a grant in here for a United Family Practice Grant, which when we get it deeper into the budget, we'll explain why that's there. And then the MMEP that many members are aware of, Minnesota Minority Education Council. So, governor's budget. Commissioner Casilius and I spend a lot of time together. The governor wants a holistic look at what are we doing in education. And so at one point, Chancellor Rosenstone and Casilius and I probably spent more time with each other than we spent with our spouses and significant others. And we hope that's on this transition to high school, to college thing. And I think the chair is going to bring that in here at some point. But the idea is it's a continuum and it's lifelong and it'll be iterative. This indicates that we want kids ready to learn. We want them ready for post-secondary. The idea is not just to get a high school diploma. It's to be ready for post-secondary. And then in post-secondary, there's a growing understanding that that'll be an iterative process, that more adults will come back during their careers to post-secondary activity. And so the governor has invested, here's his investments and his proposal. In early childhood, he's got both all-day K and scholarships, I think roughly about $100 million. In the K-12, he's got a $4 million increase, some special education, the teacher evaluation, centers for excellence, and then this work around that Casilius and myself and Chancellor Rosenstone basically are working on with others, this transition. And then in the post-secondary area, he's kind of made a balanced investment for access to need-based state grants and tuition control, I guess would be to say. At the university, it's going to be a freeze for 2 years, and he's supporting the president's notion there. And at Minsku, it's the modest, I think we'd say modest increase that Chancellor Rosenstone and the trustees have recommended. The governor is supporting both of those approaches. Specifically with Minsku, he's got the chancellor's and trustees recommendation for internships, apprenticeships, and equipment. And those are 50-50 matches, so that will make it relevant to the workforce. And the idea there is to basically reduce the skills gap and unemployment gaps. He's fully aware, as most members are, that it's not all just a problem of misalignment between education and the workforce. Some of it is wages in the area of the state you are. But at the end of the day, you know, the chancellor held 55 or 56 meetings around the state to try to work with the employment community to say, what do you need? Where are we misaligned? Let's try to fix that. And I think it's been very in-depth, and I'm sure they'll talk much more in-depth about that. And then finally, the governor, on a contingent basis, is supporting money to the University of Minnesota and basically around the research function and the tuition. So, and that's so he views it as a balanced approach for both institutional support and direct financial support to families and students, 80-80-80. And again, the university portion's contingent based on, I think, the chair and the committees. Context. Why did he choose that 80-80-80 approach? And I should mention, this is the largest percentage increase in higher ed funding for, I believe, 30 years relative to other parts of the budget. It's in the 8 or 9% range, I forget which.
Excuse me, Director Pogemiller, I don't think the committee did know about that contingent. So will you just...
Oh, I'm sorry.
We had talked about it among some of us, but
okay.
We haven't in the committee.
Let me explain that then. The governor would like to give, would like to have you invest $80 million at the University of Minnesota, basically for their research request and the freeze of tuition. Based on the activity that's going on around the publicity on their on the administrative issue, the Wall Street Journal article, the Senate has asked for, the chair and Majority Leader Bach have asked for a audit, I guess is what you'd call it. And so the governor fully supports that. And I think you're working closely with the university. And so I think the governor, he has this on the bottom line. It's money in his budget. It's in the numbers. But I think he's saying it's contingent based on the results of that audit and what the committees start to find out about how they think things are going at the U. So I think he's leaving open the possibility that if policymakers come to the conclusion that, you know, how do you say this, that maybe an $80 million investment may not be timely, he would discuss that with you. Again, it's in his budget. It's accounted for. But he's saying it's contingent on what you find out about your work with the university on that activity.
I think
that's the way he would describe it. And again, he fully would like to invest in the U, but he's as eager as you to find out what's going on. So context for why these choices. Tuition's increased in the last decade 3 times the rate of inflation and income per capita. Student debt has increased dramatically. We rank 5th in the nation with the number of students with loans and 3rd in accumulated debt. And the latest figures are that we're going to be putting out debt figures on our website by institution in the next couple of weeks here. We've been working with all the institutions. The number is 29,800. Couple caveats on that. There tends to be more debt in higher income states, and we are one of those. And there tends to be people in higher incomes tend to take on debt because they think it's all going to work out. Hmm. So this, you got to be a little sophisticated with this debt argument. All debt is not bad. The concern is that for lower and lower middle income families, it appears they're taking on debt on the bet that it's going to work out that puts them at significant risk. That's really the issue. You know, for Bill Gates, if he decides to finance the whole thing with debt, I don't think anybody's overly concerned about that. It's real, and there may be nothing wrong with that because they're making a decision. He's making a decision that I can afford that, and the cost of money, that's a smart decision for me. The issue really is the debt being accumulated by lower and lower middle income families that is probably more for many of them than they should take the risk on. That's the issue. So we're going to try to talk to you in a sophisticated way with the institutions about it. Not all debt is bad. Some of it's a good financial decision. But it's these families that are at risk that it might not work out. What we do know from the data is that a post-secondary attainment, not just attendance, but attainment, does work out economically on average. If you're not the average, then that's a problem. If it doesn't work out for you, if you don't get the kind of job that can pay back your debt, it sets you back. The undergraduate price, and Minnesota's got a fabulous set of institutions, but we're relatively high-priced in higher ed because we're a relatively high-income state. But a key point here is that the price, you can add this up different ways, but about $6.8 billion is spent in Minnesota on post-secondary education. About 5.3 of that is paid for by families. This is more of a market-type system than it is a government-run system. Most of the money, somewhere around 75% to 82%, is out of families' pockets, either with I'll come back to this later, either out of current income or debt. Then finally, you've seen the chart, and I have it in here. It is absolutely true that taxpayer investment has declined about 10% in the last decade. There's been a disinvestment, and you've seen the chart. It's in my slideshow here. Other things that are undisputed. Here's a demographic reality. It's hard for current college graduates to kind of feel this right now, but within 4 or 5 years, we're going to have a worker shortage demographically. And that has significant impact for us. We're going to, in some sense, we can't leave any children behind, not because we just care about them, but because economically we will stunt the growth of the economy if almost every child doesn't attain something post-secondarily. And the other demographic fact is that the kids that are least likely to attain post-secondarily, this is not new information, are lower income and kids of color. That's where our lowest attainment rates are. And then finally, we all know that the types of jobs are different. We're a pretty high-end economy in Minnesota, and the types of jobs are much more high-skilled. Even in the blue-collar areas, they're much more high-skilled, and you need post-secondary attainment to be successful in those jobs. Minnesota's very high. We have 70% of our high school grads go to post-secondary education. And about 25 go outside of Minnesota, though. So, and that's usually a sign that those are higher income families that have the opportunity to go outside of Minnesota because they think that works for them. That you see that around the country. The higher income states, higher income families can go out of state. We rank second in the country on the number of people ages 25 to 34 with post-secondary attainment. These are both very high nationally. The concern is we can't keep that pace up because of our demographics. Our graduation rates have been increasing. The institutions are doing better. And regardless of the institutions, they're all kind of increasing their graduation rates. This is a good thing. For different reasons, they're increasing. If you've raised your standards at your institution, it's easier to have attainment. But even in instances where people haven't raised standards, they've done some things institutionally to increase their graduation rates. Another thing to keep in back of your mind is 53% of students at two-year institutions graduate or transfer. So when you look at graduation rates, there's a lot of transferring going on and this is a good thing. They are doing their first 2 years at a two-year, and then they go to a four-year after. Again, these are the gaps racially and economically. Those are well-known. You might want to look at those a little closer, but the least attaining group is the American Indian population, and that comes up in part of the governor's recommendation here. Participation varies by race and ethnicity. Again, the least participating group is American Indians. And part of that is a gap because of post-secondary preparedness. Our inability to do well or close the achievement gap in K-12 is absolutely affecting this. Here's the enrollment trends. And I think the thing to notice from this trend is that basically everybody's pretty flat because they control enrollment, except for MNSCU and the for-profits. Out of most of our institutions, MNSCU does not control enrollment. They're basically open enrollment. But the university controls enrollment, the private colleges control enrollment, and now even an ever-increasing number of for-profit institutions are starting to control enrollment because they're under pressure from the federal government to prove that when they take a student in, they better graduate them and they better get a job. So even the for-profits are now starting to control. But when the recession hit, you can see the big jump at MNSCU, basically in the two-year institutions, and in the for-profits. Everybody else is pretty much consistently flat. We see now, though, that both at MNSCU and at the for-profits, there's a decline. As the economy gets better, it appears there's going to be fewer of those students choosing to go into those institutions. To some extent, I want to be careful how I say this. I mean it in a positive way. Our MNSCU campuses play kind of a sponge role in the economy. When unemployment is up or there's a down economy, people gravitate to the MNSCU campuses because they want to improve themselves. If they're not working, why not some education? So in that sense, it's a good thing. Less so at the private colleges or at the university, because again, they control enrollment. I'm not saying that's a bad thing. That's just their model of how they provide. Undergrad, grad, and PSEO populations at the various types of institutions. The thing to notice here is that most of the PSEO is at MNSCU, post-secondary enrollment options. I think 85% is the number. Is there someone from 82% of the PSEO students are at MNSCU. And obviously the graduate, although you can see in the private four-year colleges, there's a lot more graduate students than there used to be because they've gone into, you know, they've expanded. The private career online has also created a big graduate group. Full-time, part-time. The fact to realize here is that MNSCU is absolutely right. They've got a lot of part-time students. We will visit with the committee with a lot further detail about what that actually means. But it's just factual. There are part-time students there. The issue we want to kind of parse with you is, when are they part-time? Are they part-time right out of high school, or are they part-time coming back into the workforce? Because we think that makes a difference. The professionals in our shop thinks there's a difference there. MNSCU thinks there's a difference too. But I think understanding that part-time issue has a lot to do with understanding when people choose to be part-time. Tuition fees. I had mentioned earlier, tuition fees have gone up faster than both the rate of inflation and family incomes. And there are the trends. University of Minnesota is the highest. You got per capita and consumer price index there. This puts a little meat on the bones of most of this money is paid for by families. And the bulk of that money is out of current income and savings. But then you see the big loan portion there, the green portion, which is getting bigger and bigger. And note that the state grant program is really just an adjunct to the federal Pell Grant. The federal Pell Grant is the bigger number. But interestingly, institutional grants made by institutions in the private college sector, they buy down tuition for a lot of people. But even at the university, and to some extent at MNSCU, there are institutional grants given to students, either for merit, some are need-based. But in the big picture, institutional grants are actually bigger than Pell. Most 87% of the loans are federal loans. And there are several types. We'll get into this detail with you later, but not all federal loans are the same. Some are subsidized, some aren't. And some of the federal loans are actually more expensive for the student than a state subsidized program. That's our self-loan program. And we'll get into deal there. But most of the borrowing is because of federal, and there's quite a few nuances there with regards to why people borrow as much as they do. In Minnesota, though, because we're a little higher income, we tend to borrow more. We tend to have more people who borrow, and we tend to borrow more. The good news, though, is we have lower default rates universally at all types of institutions, and our people in Minnesota tend to pay back their loans. Here's the numbers that you can look at later on the trends on appropriations in higher ed. Here's the chart. And you can see that there are some up and downs there, but you can see that we do have a decrease, as you've seen, from 2009 in the last decade. Want to just broaden that out a little bit? And here's the chart that both Minsky and the U have been using. It's absolutely true that if you start in 1999, there's been that kind of disinvestment in public dollars. Just to put a little more context on that, though, if you look at total revenue and appropriations per student over a longer period of time, this is what it looks like. The lower dotted lines are the chart that we just saw, and it's true, those have declined. But if you look at total revenue per student, it's actually gone up, and it's gone up higher in Minnesota than in the U.S. average. That's tuition. Back then to the specifics of the governor's proposal, again, a balanced investment, 80 to the MinSKU, 80 to the U contingent, and then 80 to the state need-based grant. The MinSKU portion, the governor supports. He's very enthusiastic about both what the president and the chancellor are talking about. He thinks they've picked the correct priorities. So the $80 million for MinSKU is the internships, apprenticeships, about $12 million, leveraged equipment, $26 million. Both of those are one-for-one matches with private dollars. And he's got the chancellor and the trustees are suggesting some faculty-driven innovations in the technology area. And then for faculty and staff retention, there's been, I think it's 4 to 5 years there have not been salary increases at MinSKU. And just to retain staff, you know, just good management, you need to consider that. And so the governor has accepted the chancellor's offer to participate in that at the one-third level. University of Minnesota, again, contingent, but the governor basically supports the research innovation, the four areas that that the president and the regents are talking about, and the tuition freeze for 2 years. Then the largest investment in the state program percentage-wise in the last 25 years and the largest dollar increase in the history of the program. And he's setting the mechanism for doing that is setting tuition-free maximums to reflect what the current prices are at public institutions. The four-year maximum at the University of Minnesota is $13,526. The current program is set up at $10,400, I think, so it's about a $3,000 difference. And then at the two-year programs, those would be the new maximums. They are short. They are less. The current ones in law are lower than this. So the first is reflect the real price at those public institutions. And then something called living and miscellaneous expense would be moved from $7,000 to $8,300. And $8,300, actually, I think it's $8,318, is the federal poverty level for a single person for 9 months. So what the governor's recommending with the money he's got, that he's suggesting, is to at least go to the poverty level for a single person. And then finally, and we'll get into the technicalities of this, we're suggesting moving the student share from 46 to 50%. Here's what's currently going on in financial aid. We have a system, this is all on top of the Pell program, which is totally based on income. So the lower your income, the higher Pell grant you get. Minnesota's got a slightly different system on top of that. We have a system called shared responsibility. And we say that in Minnesota, and this has been here for 20, 25 years, the idea is there is a personal return on investment you get by going to post-secondary. You're going to get a job. So you get a personal good out of that. And so you should participate in help paying for that. But the public gets a good out of you when you get attainment because we need the workforce. And the current system says that 46% on the front end, 46% should be paid for by the student. And then the other 54% would be paid for by the taxpayer, depending on your income, either your family or the taxpayer, depending on your income. And so under today's current system, we set it up and say the recognized price of a tenant is the addition of the numbers you set, which are LME, which is at 7,000, and the university's number, which is at 10,488. But the university's number is really 3,000 lower than it is in reality, and the LME number is low. The university uses about 12,500 as their number. We're saying at least get to the poverty level. And so there's an implicit in the model, the student is actually paying 57%. They're not really paying 46% because there's this cost out there that we don't recognize when we distribute financial aid. So what we're recommending is get this price more realistic. Get back by going, adding 3,000 to the tuition and fees, adding 1,300 to LME, you get closer to the real cost, which is about 21,800. That gives us this second chart. So here's where the governor's going. Let's tell people on the front end what the real costs are. And we're saying, all right, you're going to pay 50%. But that's still lower than the 57% you're currently paying. Even though it's not the 46%, it's lower than the 57 you're really paying. And so both the grant increases and you have a more realistic amount for the student responsibility. Student pays this out of work, loans, or if mom and dad have more than the family responsibility here, mom and dad help pay for that. But it's a responsibility for the student to pay his or her fair share. And we'll have much broader. This is a U of M example. You have similar charts for, and the U of M example would be the same as for the private colleges. This example, later we can show you a Minsky example too for both 2-year and 4-year. So here's what happens. And under the governor's suggestion of spending that $80 million, you roughly get 5,000, over 5,000 additional students will become eligible for grants. And here's the income ranges. And the grants will be increased between up to about $1,400, depending on what your situation. The grants will tend to be bigger if you're at the university or a private college, because moving that cap up $3,000 is going to drive the money that way. But under the way this is set up, with the LME increase, with the living and maintenance increase, all students currently on the grant program will get increases. And the way it's set up, we've built in both the university's freeze and the proposed tuition increases at Minsky. And this, in effect, will buy off for grant recipients the tuition increases at Minsky, in addition to some of them will get additional money, but at a minimum, it'll buy off their tuition increase. Whoops. Other recommendations.
Senator Bonner, would you repeat?
Senator Sharon.
Would you go through that again, talking about the impact of this recommended change on the Minsky system as compared to the private institutions and
the university. Back to this chart.
The rationale for why we want to drive the dollars towards students that are there rather than the Minsky system.
Okay. First, keep in mind, it's not a question of where we're driving it. It's a question of where the students choose to attend. That's the premise of allowing the student to choose their institution. And what this says is that since we are so far off on what the real cost of going to the University of Minnesota is, we should recognize what that real cost is. And so by raising that cap, you in effect, which affects the university and all the private colleges that tend to have, they're higher than the university, but this is at the university's dollar amount. By doing that, you in effect fix the issue of students having an unrecognized $3,000 cost for going to the U that the system doesn't cover. It kind of gives you a unequal distribution of the dollars in grants across institutional choice. And so since
Excuse
the Minsky
me, but
tuitions
the,
tend to be
Senator,
lower.
Director Polkum, Senator Sharon.
Doctor, huh?
Director, I said.
Oh, director. Senator Director.
I never finished my thesis.
Yeah, I understand. Believe me.
It was there, but I never finished that thesis.
In joking, I might have lost my point. I think in earlier discussions, when we've had discussions about this very issue about student grants, these institutions have a decision about what they're going to do in terms of raising tuition as well. I mean, we're trying to build in a system that encourages efficiency so that the educational costs are not continuing to rise. This deals with the fact that there is rising tuition in all of the systems.
Correct.
But it really creates it's not truly an incentive, but using the fact that they're raising the tuition to also control where these dollars go, instead of sort of having more dollars available for students to choose excellent education. But in the Minsky system, this really, it seems to me, when we change this methodology, we change the number of dollars that are available for students who might choose to go to a Minsky system, because there's a finite amount of money.
We're not changing the methodology. We're trying to recalibrate this to what the methodology has been historically. And the reason I pointed out that the bulk of this is family money, I think we will be able to convince you over a period of time that no matter how much we put in the state grant program, that's not driving where they're setting the price. The price is being set by outside factors, by a market.
Well, I understand that. I don't think it's a student grant program that's driving tuition.
It is absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
So if it's not driving tuition, the only issue at stake here is choice. Which students can afford to go to which institutions? And the Minnesota tradition has been, since shared responsibility was put in 20, 25 years ago, was the policy choice was, we would like students to choose the best institution that fits their needs. And that may be the university. That might be Mankato. That might be a two-year institution. Or it might be St. Thomas. So what I would argue is that what we're doing is, by recalibrating this to the reality of what's really going on, prices that we're not setting, this is not about cost right now. This is just about price. We're saying we want to get back to a point where a student should be able to choose the institution that best fits them, regardless of their financial circumstance.
And yet, Director Pogamiller, I think what Senator Sharon, and you can tell me if I'm not understanding this, what you're responding to is when you choose to recalibrate it by raising the cap, then proportionally it's going to allow those students who do choose the University of Minnesota or the private not-for-profits a greater share, and perhaps then give them an incentive to go that way versus the others. Is that somehow capturing your concern?
Okay. Except when they make that choice, their student responsibility goes up too, because they're paying under this proposal, they're going to pay 50%. Whatever choice they pick, if they pick the higher cost choice, state grant doesn't pick all that up. They're picking up. So if they choose to go to that higher cost institution, they're choosing to increase their own cost. So I think we would argue that we don't think, we think it actually, well, it's a long extended discussion, but we think what's going on is because of this miscalculation, some students are choosing a lower cost institution so they can basically make money on the deal. Relatively.
Well, now there's
you never get enough money. You never,
Senator Sharon.
Under the whole system, under the whole system, even a combined Pell and state grant, you never pay the total cost of tuition fees and living in miscellaneous expenses. But at the university and private colleges, you never pay more than just tuition and fees with both Pell and living in miscellaneous. At some of the Minsky campuses, your living in miscellaneous gets you into where you are actually paying some of the student share, potentially. So the student...
But the benefit of the living and maintenance...
Senator Sharon.
Miscellaneous that you fund is that it's equivalent across the systems. It doesn't make any difference which system you're going to.
Correct, except for the your eligibility for it, except keep in mind as you move, the student share, as the price changes, the student share goes up. So it's not like it's being made up for by the grant program. And there's a federal cap of, is it $5,500? What's the maximum Pell Grant you can get is $5,500. So what we're actually talking about here is access to institutions, not students choosing higher price because they're getting more grant money. What they're really doing is saying, well, if I can get some grant money, I maybe will put in more of my personal family, or I'll work more hours or something, or take on more debt. I mean, the real issue now is too much of this is becoming debt by students.
I'm sure that this will be discussed more thoroughly.
Well, Senator Sharon, we actually have reserved a committee time to really go through the state grant program, because it is really confusing and it is such a big part of the whole higher ed puzzle.
Other recommendations above the $80 million in the state grant. The governor is recommending an additional $2.4 million to cover students who qualify under this deferred action at the national level. A student who is not does not have a Social Security number, has lived in the country for 15 years, tries to go to college, is not eligible for federal grants or state grants, and what the federal government is doing is they've created this thing called deferred action status that says, well, if you fill out this paperwork and stuff, we will allow you to participate. But so it's a subset of kind of DREAM Act kids, students. It's a subset of that. And this would make it eligible if you go through the work. And we think there's probably potentially about 1,400 students in Minnesota that will go through the federal recognition process, and we think perhaps half of them or something would be eligible for state grant. So, and this is on top of the $80 million. In addition, the governor maintains the state's commitment to the tuition reciprocity. We have three of them. We have with Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota. North Dakota and Wisconsin are the two that are most active. In both cases, I think we have about 14,000 Minnesotans going to Wisconsin, about 10,000 Wisconsinites coming to Minnesota. They send us a check for about $6 million a year. North Dakota, we have 14,000 going and 5 coming from North Dakota, I think. And we pay them. We send about $6 million to North Dakota. And so the governor wants to maintain that, and that would be the increased cost of maintaining that. American Indian Scholarship. I mentioned earlier, one group has a scholarship on top of the state grant program, on top of the Pell Grant. And in Minnesota, it's the American Indian Scholarship. We don't have a Hispanic scholarship program. We don't have an African-American scholarship program. Historically, the policy idea was, when they created this years ago, was that there's something special about this population. And the best way to describe that, the University of Minnesota Morris used to be an American Indian college through federal activity. And the University of Minnesota took it over. And today, I believe, Minnesota American Indian students still can go to Morris for free because of that long-term relationship. The issue is many aren't prepared to go there. And so we have this, Minnesota has this scholarship program currently. And we factor in if the tribes are putting in money for the student. For example, the Mendowakan and Shakopee don't access this because they already have a program to take care of their students. So this would mostly be rural American Indian students where the tribes are not able, the communities are not able to pay, apparently. So the current system that we have takes care of it's about 500 short of taking care of all the students who apply. This would fully fund that waiting list. I want to be careful not to say that it fully funds every student that will be eligible, because what might happen here is if we fully fund the waiting list, more students might go, oh, I've got a shot. And then the waiting list would grow again, perhaps. But the argument here is this is the lowest attaining group in Minnesota by far. And so anything special we can do here is a smart thing to do. And finally, there's an appropriation for something called the Statewide Longitudinal Educational Data System. This is something that's been developed by federal grants in the K-12 Department of Education. It's happening around the country. And what people are trying to do is link data from early childhood to the workforce through all the delivery systems, public providers, private providers. and try to figure out what paths work. What kind of education did you get? What kind of job did you get? And Minnesota is, the decision's been made to make this office the face of SLEDS. And I think partly because we already deal in kind of a market system in higher ed where the private colleges are already giving information to this. We're going to encourage the K-12 schools, parochial schools, to also give information to this system. And so about 800,000 of that, or about 1.2 million of that per year is just a pass-through from us to Minute, the new computer, centralized computer people in Minnesota, because that's what it costs to run the machine, basically, the black box. 600,000 of that would be for additional development of data and connecting data between delivery systems. This includes DEED and their workforce data, K-12, and higher ed, basically. Eventually, we'll want to connect early childhood data and healthcare data and whatever else people think might matter in terms of trying to figure out what's happening to people. Madam Chair, that...
Senator Peterson.
I may have gone through all these specifically already. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Pogemiller. I'm very actually interested in SLEDS and have been engaged in that issue. And going back to the appropriation, I don't know... You could really do a committee hearing on SLEDS,
yes,
and the data
I
capacity
agree.
And what we can do with all of that. Could you just talk a little bit more about where we're at with what we can do with data, what kind of data we have on the P20 continuum, and what kind of the future vision of the department is and how you're going to utilize that, given that you've said you've been assigned to be the face of SLEDS.
And just for information, next Thursday, the topic for that committee is both the state grant and SLEDS. Go ahead.
And at that hearing, we're going to bring in kind of the first data out of that that shows it's going to be, you're going to enjoy it. It starts to show what is actually happening because it's got a flow chart of follows students who started, who left, did they show up at another institution? It's going to be some interesting stuff. And we've already done, at some point, the governor or MMB is going to put out a dashboard for Minnesota. And on that dashboard is the first rough attempt to connect educational experience and debt with what you're getting paid in the workforce now. And it's going to be very rough, but we will show you that information at this hearing about what's been developed there. And the person in our, if you want a little more explanation now, the person in our office works on this is a woman, Meredith Fergus. And I don't know, do you want to add anything there right now, Meredith? Do you want more on that right now? Because we can tell you exactly what data sets are in there
and
what
ones are
coming.
There's a lot there. And I can give you a week until we come back for the hearing. One thing just I would say, give you a week to work on, since I would imagine you're taking care of TSDL then too, or the teacher-student data link issue.
Committee, I'm Meredith Fergus, policy analyst with the Minnesota Office of Higher Education. That link is actually still within the Minnesota Department of Education. However, they do have the broader plans of linking it to the larger SLED system as well. Yes.
Okay. All right. I'll reserve the rest of my questions for the next hearing.
Thanks, Senator Peterson. But to that point, I wonder if you could, when we're having this discussion, have somebody from that department be present during that hearing. I think that particularly given the makeup of this committee, there is going to want to be we're going to want to talk to both. Thanks.
Certainly, Madam Chair.
Yeah, we should bring a DEED and a K-12.
That'd be great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Fergus.
And I just a heads up there, we will probably be discussing with you how better we can connect data. And so, because right now we don't use Social Security as a connector. Other states do. And so that gives you some limitations on how you can connect data. And so whether we'll ask for you to consider allowing us to use Social Security number or not, that's not determined yet, but there's some really significant issues here in terms of how rich you can make the data if you can connect the data sets. And the technical people, this is a much longer discussion, but the technical people tell us they absolutely can protect privacy and all of that. So,
Madam Chair.
I know people
Senator
have feelings
Ertman.
About that.
Director Pogomiller, congratulations on your confirmation.
Thank
today.
You, Senator.
I was going to say you might want to start with Senator Limmer on that question. No, data practices.
The Privacy Committee.
Exactly. Yes. Just a quick question about merit scholarships. I know we don't do them in Minnesota. I'm very interested in them. And I'm wondering if your office has done any research about the success of them in other states and had done any planning on whether or not that would be a good use of state funds for the future for Minnesota.
We can work up Director. Something for you on that. And I think we had an example of what we had 2 or 3 years ago, Governor Plenty's initiative. We have some history on that. And so we'll try to come up with something for you that is expressive of what we think is going on there or is possible.
Madam Chair, and
yep. And you said on merit scholarships,
Senator,
right?
Merit scholarships, yes. Director Pogomiller, I introduced an amendment last year on that, and I'm very interested in introducing it again this year. So you might want to pull that. But any research you might have or any suggestions you might have about how we might be able to add this to this package, because I think if we could incentivize high school students, we could really have a big impact on our workforce and economic development if they see the incentive to educate themselves and they see Minnesota's investment in them. And so I don't know whether we can do it now or not, but I hope this committee will consider that, Madam Chair, and look at the information that they might have for us in that department.
Well, I think it might be better if we put together some information for you and then have an extended discussion of it.
That'd
be great. I think, as I understand it, listening to the professional staff, the thing to consider is who plays which role in this, and there's a lot of merit scholarships going out in the institutions. And it's a question of, okay, how most effectively, as they're trying to put their student body together, and so I think that's what we want to think about. Who does the need-based piece, who does the merit piece, and what works?
Senator Ortman? I would welcome any legislation on that subject. I would love to hear that.
Well, Madam Chair, I will be introducing it. I want to get some more information from the department. I do want to work with them. But I'm fascinated by what's been happening in Georgia and other states with their high school academic merit programs. I just think it would be great for Minnesota.
Thank you. And
we'll work with Senator Ortman. We'll pull the information together, show you what we have, and then you can say, well, how about this? How about that? We'll try to put something together for the committee.
And if members would remember, Governor Plenty briefly introduced his every B student gets to attend the university, and it didn't
achieve.
Go. Pardon?
It was in law for a few years. Achieve.
It seemed like it was very brief. So.
How many years? 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And Madam Chair, it wouldn't be nearly as broad as what I'm suggesting and what's been happening in these other states. And I hope we'll look at what we can do.
Thanks. Anybody else? Okay.
Madam Chair, that's answer questions, or I think I went through everything.
Director Pogomiller, it went faster than you thought.
Yeah.
Very good. So
yes.
One thing we didn't talk about, and we have not yet talked about around the committee table, and I'm wondering if you could just give us your thoughts about the role of this MOOCs, and I know we don't have the capacity in current law to open that door, and if you have a position on that, what do you think?
Well, actually, Madam Chair, one of the
committee members, MOOCs is the massive open online courses, and this is happening in particular. MIT and Stanford have gotten a lot of press because some of their best professors have now opened up their courses free of charge to anybody. And the issue then becomes, how are the institutions, or are they willing to provide credit if students take these types of courses? So.
Madam Chair and members, the MOOC didn't exist about a year ago, the notion of it. And it's developing rapidly. And there's a question about what will be useful, what won't be useful. And part of our policy recommendations is we're going to ask you to fix a law that basically says we have to charge someone offering free online course for no credit. We have to charge them to register with us. And if you're talking about a provider who's got 14 colleges giving them 200 courses, that could get pretty expensive for somebody. And so you might have read in the paper that I made the decision to not enforce strictly that statute until you came into town. And so part of our recommendation is going to be you should fix that statute and say if it's free, if it's not for credit, someone shouldn't have to spend money in Minnesota to offer a free, not-for-credit course if they happen to be in Massachusetts or San Francisco. As part of that discussion, I received a call from the two young founders of something called Coursera. They're two professors on the West Coast, and I don't know exactly how old they are, but I think they're about 33 or 4 or 5. And if the committee's interested, Madam Chair, they told me they wanted to help us think through this, and they have offered to come to Minnesota and talk to you if you would like.
We'd love that.
And they know a lot more about what's going on there than, I mean, we read about it, but these are the actual entrepreneurs that are doing it. And they are moving from free, not for credit, to some for credit, and they're thinking about how would we charge somebody to do the testing and stuff, and it's moving pretty quickly. It won't be a panacea for all of higher ed. I mean, not everything's going online, but it certainly creates a lot of activity around what's available and what. But I mean, you know, you literally can have the most famous professor in the area of cell bionics offering you a course, and on some of these courses they've had like. I remember reading one where they had 160,000 people who, worldwide, who took the course. Now, only, you know, 10,000 of them actually finished the course. But still, if only 10,000 finished, that's a lot of people. And then you've obviously got quality issues. You know, how do you maintain that? But the way the higher ed currently works, that quality is determined. If the University of Minnesota decides to give somebody credit for a course they took, that's something they decide. We don't decide that. And you are quickly moving to a point with Harvard and MIT going so big into this, it just seems inevitable that they're going to start accepting credit at Harvard and MIT for some of this. Yeah. And if Harvard and MIT do it, it just seems like it will tend to filter out, but maybe not. So, Madam Chair, they've offered to come. If the committee's interested in that, I would invite them and have them tell you from the creators what they do.
Yep. Seems, Dr. Pogemiller, there's interest around the table. We'd love to hear from them.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we'll work with your staff to see when it would be a good time. And
great. And then another question that I wondered if you could address is, given the committee's interest in graduation completion and then looking at policy questions, what can we do to create incentives for completion? One of the things we've been grappling with, and you may see some legislation that could get this conversation started, and I did mention it to you a little bit, is have you or your staff considered having a cash flow plan with regard to the state grant so that there's money left aside for completion that only gets in the students' pockets for completion. And I know that creates the question, is it the responsibility of the institution versus the student? Where does that lie?
Madam Chair, we hear you. The governor has said directly to me, as other commissioners, we are obviously advocating for his ideas, his balanced approach. But he said if the committees have better ideas or different ideas or and they fit in, absolutely. So whatever you're thinking about, I offer our professional staff to help work with you to develop your own ideas, and let's pick the best ones out of all this. This is the most significant investment. The proposal is the most significant investment in post-secondary proportionally in many, many years. So I think the governor would like to work with you here and figure out what works.
Anything else? Okay. There being no further business for the committee, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.